Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon.
When I was a little girl growing up in Detroit, my dad used to take me to see shows when they'd come into town. And we'd sit in about the third row, and I'd look up on the stage, and the people up there just always looked so happy to be there. And I thought to myself that that's what I wanted to do, and that's where I wanted to be. And I remember when they'd come right down near the foot of the stage, and they'd look out, I always was sure they were looking right at me, right at little Gilda Radner. And now that I'm finally up here, I can't see a thing.
Gilda Radner was one of the seven original Not Ready for Primetime players on Saturday Night Live. She created some of the show's most memorable characters, including Judy Miller, Baba Wawa, and Roseanne Rosanna Dana. Her legacy has inspired the next wave of SNL cast members and comedians. Filmmaker Lisa Dapolito has created a new documentary about Gilda's life and career. It's called Love Gilda. To tell her story, Lisa gained access to exclusive content from Gilda's journals, photos, videos, and even her audio tapes.
Gilda's brother had had these boxes that were in storage since Gilda passed away, and he didn't really know what was in them. Mm-hmm. And it took a little convincing, but Gilda's best friend Judy and I convinced him to go into the storage unit and take his boxes out. And in the boxes were the first thing we found was a videotape that Gilda made while she was going through her chemotherapy.
Are you filming now?
Yes, dear.
Oh, I was panicked this time. I didn't want to come for this treatment. I thought if I filmed it, you know, it would add a dimension to take my mind off of it.
And then there were audio tapes in there and photos and her writings and journals. I mean, it took a period of, you know, several trips to Detroit to really get the nerve to, like, take, you know, it's a kind of weird when you have somebody's physical things.
Mm-hmm. If you didn't have access to all of this material, the film wouldn't have been nearly as successful as it is, don't you think?
I think it would have been a typical documentary about people talking about how great Gilda was, and it would show her sketches, and the modern day comedians would talk about how they were inspired by her. But I think it would have been a traditional doc. So once I heard her her audio tapes, I was like, oh my God, if Gilda could tell her story in her voice, that would be amazing.
I found that my comfort in live television was laughter, that I can do almost anything if people are laughing. That's what hugs me and holds me and gets things out of me.
But one of the problems with it were the audio tapes were severely damaged. It was really, I was on a mission that Gilda was going to tell her story. And there were times that my team were telling me, like, oh, we'll just get an actress in and they could read Gilda's parts. Or we can get somebody who plays, you know, the audience won't know the difference if you're using an actress. And I was like, no, it has to be Gilda. So with a lot of audio work and a lot of a team of an amazing dialogue restorer, I think it worked in the end.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered amongst all the material, the audio, the video recordings, the journal?
Well, I guess two things. Listening to Gilda talk, She was obviously really funny in real life, but so intelligent and so acute of people and situations. But I think the most revealing thing was in her journals. And it was the journal, we use a bit of it in the film, which is about 1978, and it's at the height of Gilda's her fame. She has an Emmy. She's on the cover of all these magazines. She checked herself into a hospital for her eating disorder, and she kept a diary about her loneliness.
You mentioned the importance of Gilda's childhood. Can you tell me a bit about her early years?
Well, Gilda was born to, I mean, her parents were very affluent, and her father was much older when she was born. And she was the apple of his eye. And it was a family that humor was very, very important in the family. So she was always entertaining her father. And I think she was also a chubby child. Uh-huh. So she was made fun of. And her mother put her on diet pills when she was young. So there was something that Gilda never felt. She always felt as an outsider. She felt overweight. and people made fun of her when she was little, and she was able to turn that around by making people laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she also had a nanny from the time that she was born, and her nanny became a big influence in her life. And then when her father died, it really impacted her. She was always looking for that unconditional love that she got from her father. And I think that's why she had so many relationships with men, maybe not the positive relationships, but she was always looking for that love, whether it was a love of an audience or a love of a person. But that was really Gilda's quest, was always to find that sort of love.
I am going to kill you right now. Oh, no!
I'd like to take that balance beam and stick it in her eye.
What is that bewitching scent you're wearing?
Vicks Vapor Rub.
Gilda created many very popular characters on Saturday Night Live, and she became very famous very fast. Did she have trouble dealing with her fame?
Well, I think they all became famous really fast,
whole
cast. And it was a different period of time where a dozen television stations at the time. Mm-hmm. And the college students were really the big fans of the show. And they would watch, many people told me they'd get into a dorm room or they'd be like 20, 30 people watching the show. So when the cast did their first show in New Orleans, which was like a year, they did a live show.
Yeah.
There were hundreds or thousands of people mobbing them, and they didn't know how popular that they were, because I think somebody said the Nielsen ratings couldn't really tell because they went by household.
Mm.
So they were really, really popular fast. And in New York, this is the 70s too. So that was a really different time. And I think with Gilda, from what I heard and what she talks about, she loved going out into the street and being among people. And at first she loved being recognized. But then it got to a point where she was really mobbed in places. Her friend had told me that they were in the ladies' room and Gilda was in the bathroom stall, and there were people putting autograph things under the door for her to sign.
I can't tell if guys are looking at me because I'm a girl and maybe just attractive, or if they're just looking at me because they recognize me from the show and I'll maybe never know again.
Being funny got me famous, and being famous is almost as bad for dating as being funny.
Do you think that might be the reason that her first husband was G.E. Smith?
It's so interesting. I tried to interview G.E., but I couldn't get to him because I wanted to hear his point of the story. Because nobody in Gilda's life, none of her friends, knew that they were dating.
Huh.
And the relationship kind of came and went so fast.
Yeah, it was just a couple of years, right?
And no one really had much to say, and nobody knew why she married him. And, maybe it was the first, somebody said maybe it's the first person that asked her.
Yeah, and then shortly after that, she met Gene Wilder, who became her second husband. How did they meet?
Well, they met on the set of Hanky Panky.
In my apartment.
This is Nathan Curry's apartment.
You're a friend of Nathan Curry?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Michael Jordan. He's got my apartment in Chicago. We exchanged apartments.
When did he leave?
I don't know when he left. I've been here a week. The agents in Chicago arranged for it. They didn't say anything about you.
Oh, I'm Kate Hellman. I'm really sorry.
How do you do?
I thought you were a burglar.
I thought you were a burglar. Well, when you opened the door, I almost bashed your brains in.
What was Gilda and Gene's relationship like?
Gilda adored him. She wrote to him, she wrote love stories to him. She talked about him all the time. She just adored him. So I always say that he really was the love of her life.
Uh-huh.
And, from his point of view, he wrote a book. And I got to spend a day with Gene about a year before he died, which was pretty amazing. And he said to me he couldn't live with her and he couldn't live without her.
Huh.
And so I don't know. I mean, I think they're both, he was so sweet and so also childlike. So I could imagine they had a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. I find that very interesting that he told you that he couldn't live with Gilda and he couldn't live without her. Did he go into any more detail about that?
I think she was very needy in the sense there's like this famous story. It's not in the film. It's in her book. And everybody told me the story and it never, ever made sense. So the story is that Jean married Gilda because her dog ate rat poison.
Really?
Yeah, and I was like, well, how did that work? And they're like, oh, well, Jean and Gilda were supposed to were flying to France, and her dog got sick. So she said to Jean, you fly without me. And she took care of the dog. And then when Jean got back, he said, you know, will you marry me?
Huh.
And he told me that story, too.
Yeah.
And so it was basically, it was the idea that she didn't need him as much. Like, she made an independent decision, which I think that's... Their relationship was progressing in that way.
On Monday, October 20th, the phone rang. It was my internist. He checked me into the hospital immediately for tests. He said, very calmly, we've discovered there is a malignancy. I had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
How did she deal with this news?
Well, I think she had been, you know, we don't go into detail that much detail in the film because it is really hard to put like a whole story into somebody's life in an hour and a half. But she really was going to doctors for a while and not feeling well. And they were telling her that she was a hypochondriac or she had Epstein-Barr. And according to Jean's nephew, Jordan, she kept telling the doctors that she had cancer. I think from what I heard, her diagnosis was really only a couple months to live. And she did wind up living 2.5 years and really sort of, you know, enjoying her life with Jean and with her friends and reconnecting with her SNL friends. So I think she was sad until, you know, she went to this place called the Wellness Community, which is the kind of the founding basis of Gilda's Club. And she met other people with cancer and she was able to, you know, talk to people who were going through the same things that she was going through.
Mm-hmm. While she was sick, Gilda decided that she wanted to make cancer funny. So she asked for help from her old SNL writing partner, Alan Zweibel. How did Alan help Gilda make cancer funny?
Well, Alan and Gilda were really, after Gilda had a long period of time, or at the beginning periods of Jean, she wasn't really with the SNL crowd, but her and Alan were always friends through thick and thin. And Alan was working on a show called It's Gary Shandling Show, and Gilda was supposed to be on the show before she was sick, actually, or when she just got sick. And so she did a guest appearance on the show, and she makes fun of cancer. So her and Alan worked on their script. And I think, you know, I love the fact that Gilda was able to go back on television, was able to talk about cancer, and had that moment.
Hi, Gary.
Oh, Gilda, it's Gilda Radner, everybody. Don't milk the applause like that.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gary. I haven't been on television for a while.
Oh, that, yeah. What was wrong?
Oh, I had cancer. What did you have?
Oh. It's funny, and also it's poignant. It's a very memorable scene. What do you think is Gilda Radner's legacy?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's so many comedians, so many people in comedy are inspired by her.
Yeah.
She has a really solid place, I think. You know, she was inspired by, I mean, in terms of women, but also she inspires many, many people like Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Tina Fey, who are inspiring now a new generation of comedians who will inspire a new generation. So I think she has a pretty solid legacy there. And then in terms of Gilda's Clubs, you know, there's 18 of them. There's hundreds of thousands of people through the years who have been helped by these programs. So I think she has a pretty interesting legacy.
Yeah. At one point in your film, Gilda says that her biggest motivation has always been love.
Well, I think love is like the whole message of Gilda.
Yeah.
In general. That's why it's like the film was called Love Gilda from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would talk to people and they'd be like, I love Gilda.
Yeah.
And then I have all these letters from her where she actually signs Love Gilda. But love was, I mean, all the people I talked to, you know, I interviewed maybe 70 people.
Wow.
You know, by phone.
Yeah.
A lot of people just by phone. And no one really, everyone was like, she was the sweetest, the nicest, the most giving, the most generous. So I think there's Gilda was not just somebody who wanted to be loved. She was somebody who really loved.
To be famous is more or less a stab at immortality.
A chance to leave your name and your work and the memory of millions of people.
Unfortunately, it doesn't help you personally with being dead.
Because once you're dead, it really doesn't matter much to you about restaurants and what's on television.
I was thinking I'd like to be buried with a television at my feet, and I'd like to have my tombstone read,
Gilda Radner had a great time.
I just want to make sure anybody passing by my grave gets a good laugh.
A good, deep, mortal laugh, even if I don't hear it.
Lisa Dapolito is the director of the CNN Films documentary Love, Gilda. You can find out more about Lisa, her film, and Gilda at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Why are you ever immature?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
You're not too bright, are you?
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
You sound like a real attractive...